Hello and welcome to One Game at a Time, where this week we look at the Brownlow Medal as we continue to track the development of the game that we know and love. You can find us on the Facebook at One Game at a Time or the Twitter handle, which is at Origins of Footy, and we welcome anything you've got to say, whether it be positive, negative or otherwise. And it's a big hello to Ryan Miller.
Good evening. How are we going, guys?
Good, thank you.
Good.
I'm excited about tonight. It's just massive in Melbourne at the moment. The sun's sure come out.
Sure is.
We've got Brownlow camp this week. Records being set. And then we're into the, you know, the big dance, I guess, on Saturday.
And good afternoon to you, Finn O'Sullivan.
Yes, g'day, gentlemen. I'm pumped for this episode because I want to talk about the man himself, Charles Brownlow, which I don't think many people know much about.
No, only to hear Bruce McAvaney say, who will take Charlie home tonight? But before we get to all things Brownlow, we have heard from many people this week and it's time for Mailbag.
I'll go first, I think, because I'm excited. We've got Alistair from Swift's Creek. Now, Swift's Creek, I wasn't entirely sure where it was. Okay. But it's...
sounds like something out of an Enid Blyton novel.
Sounds like a lovely place. Up in the northeast, I believe, not far from Bairnsdale. Quite far from Bairnsdale, but it's near Bairnsdale.
It's closer to Bairnsdale than Melbourne.
Yes, that's very true. But he asked a great question. Obviously, Dustin Martin scored the highest Brownlow vote count total this week. But he asked, what was the lowest? And, well, I suppose in the modern era, you had 1986 Dipper and Greg Williams playing for Hawthorn and Sydney Swans, respectively. Had 17 votes, but like we tend to do, we've gone back a little bit further than that. And if you go back to 1930, there were 4 votes for the winner. There were 3 winners that year: Stan Judkins, who played for Richmond as well, Harry Collier, and Alan Hopkins. And they had 4 votes. Massive 4. Must have been an exciting night. There would have been a lot of people in that vote count who were very excited with a couple of rounds to go. And we have a, you know, joint tied of 20 players waiting to work out who's going to win the Brownlow that year.
Sports bet feeling really stupid. Yeah, and they already paid out on Stan Judkins before the count was over.
But obviously, this is going back before the modern system of 3-2-1, where... obviously, the best player on the ground was given 1 vote, and that was it. So, different systems, but hopefully that answers Alistair's question.
Yeah, and the one thing that I do know about that 3 players tied at 4 votes was they didn't have a countback system, obviously, because there was no 3-2-1, there was no best on ground to judge it by. So, they were able to discriminate and make sure that one person won by judging them on the one who had the fewest games. And that's how they determined who was the winner that year.
Oh, nice.
They were subsequently all awarded Brownlows later in time, but at that time, only one player was the winner. Finn?
Well, Charles Brownlow. He was recruited from the local junior club, North Geelong, and he began playing for the Geelong Footy Club around the early 1880s. And remember, this was a time where Geelong was the only senior team in town after Barwon amalgamated with Chinwell in 1879. Interestingly, during this time, I don't think many people would know this, that he actually played under the pseudonym of Green due to his father not approving of his interest in footy. So according to Mark Pennings, the charade was up when Brownlow began playing for the seniors in 1881, and Mr. Brownlow was heard barracking enthusiastically for Green after a bit of splendid play that he just did. A friend of Mr. Brownlow was amused by this, and as he was aware of his son's alias, he asked to Mr. Brownlow, "Don't you know who you're cheering for? You're cheering for your own son. Surely after this, you can continue. You can't continue to forbid him to play senior football." So apparently Mr. Brownlow was dumbfounded once he discovered the truth and congratulated his son after the game. Now, to me, this sounds very romantic, but apparently this this has happened, and Mark Pennings has put this in his book, Origins of Footy. But look, after that, He took over Jimmy Wilson as captain in 1883. He retired due to severe rheumatism. He captained the Petonians to a VFA premiership that year. And club historian Cole Hutchison suggested he's credited for coming up with the unheard-of tactic of the time of playing players in set roles. So, for example, if someone could kick straight, he preferred to play them in the forward line. Mm. If someone was fast, he'd play them in a position that would utilise his pace on the wings or in the midfield. According to the Australasian, he was one of the champions of the colony in 1883, and we might discuss that further. He lasted only a year and a bit in the captaincy due to health problems, as well as wanting to dedicate more time to his business. Harry Steedman took over, and for the next 6 years, Brownlow played on a part-time basis, so he would just play, you know, wherever he could. Then in during 1885, Brownlow became club secretary. This was going to be a difficult job as Geelong was moving out of that early dominant era of the late 1870s and early 1880s. In fact, during the 1894 season, Brownlow stated that if Geelong continued to finish third and fourth, they continued to lose funds, blaming other clubs' professionalism for Geelong's debt. £1,600, and we discussed that a few episodes ago. Specifically, Brownlow's openly stated his aspiration at Essendon, trying to acquire Geelong players through payments in 1894. Apparently, they were walking around Geelong trying to scout players. Brownlow then asserted that the only way to eliminate professionalism was to secure parliamentary legislation to force clubs to donate a certain percentage of their gate takings to charity. This stance copped considerable flak when it was discovered that Geelong was also paying players at the same time. So after years and years of being secretary and being in that administrative roles, he became the president of the Australasian Football Council in 1919 and was in this position until his death, where, as discussed in previous episodes, Ernest Copeland took over in 1924. So that's a brief outline of his incredible career.
That's fantastic.
So he's administrative in the enormous contribution that he made to the game, it sounds like. But a quality player previous to that. But really what he provided for the game is in an administrative capacity. You mentioned that champions of the colony thing. I did some research on this. This was something that was done in the 1940s and 50s. A guy called Mullen just looked back at a period of time from 1856 onwards, and he just named a series of players who were the champions of the colony.
Yeah,
just
wow.
Because he felt like it.
The Mullins medal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, for example, he's got the winner of the first two champions of the colony awards, Tom Wills.
Yeah.
I feel like we could have done that. Yeah. Just get to look back and go, geez, he looks pretty good.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when you go and read, if you read any of those sort of books that have this kind of thing, particularly any Australian rules books that look at it year by year, it'll have champion of the colony there, but it wasn't a legitimate award. You know, no one turned up in a suit and had the red carpet treatment. It was just something that was done well after the fact. To put a name to the best player of that year, but there was no legitimate vote count or anything like that. It was just a contribution by this guy called Mullen. Is that about right, Finn?
Yeah, it is about right. And Mark Pennings has stated in his book Origins of Australian Football that this bloke Mullen has invented this list, but it has expressed his personal opinion about the best player over the years. Unfortunately, this has been interpreted by others as fact, and has now become so ingrained that some historians and journalists refuse to believe otherwise. Mike Pennings goes on to say that it was basically the media that made up their mind who was the champion of the colony. Yep. The one that I just mentioned in 1883, where Brownlow was one of the champions of the colonies, there were eight others in that year. So just like the premiership, in inverted commas, it was up to the media to determine who was the best team, because remember, at that stage, all teams were playing different amount of games.
There were exhibitions.
Yeah, so it was impossible to tell. Some were playing juniors, some were playing and regional teams as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting at this point, I think it's worth highlighting that, why did this occur? Why don't they have a best player of the year kind of award going on? And why does it take so long for the, I suppose, Brownlow medal to come into existence, as we as we know it today to a certain extent. If you look around the world and you start looking at world sport, as I tend to do, there's not an enormous amount of this, particularly in England as well. They don't really go about naming the best player and saying this guy's the best person in the con. I mean, you can find that kind of information,
like a
but it's not like they have a ceremony where they go like, this person is the best going. This is getting, he's doing it on purpose now, and it's always when I'm speaking for him, he cracks a beer open.
Two-stroke penalty. Yeah.
As I was saying, that it's, I think it's a fascinating thing, and something that maybe people don't realise so much in this country is that once again, and I've said this many, many times, the Brownlow Medal, not only the way it's selected, how the point system's tallied, but also just the idea of presenting someone with this best and fairest medal is incredibly unique, like really, really unique. I think it's worth noting at this point that, you know, this is not something that's going on around the world. It's like, well, you know, maybe it's this idea of the gentleman activity again back in England, that not making a big deal about the one individual who is the best player in the competition, whether it's rugby or football or soccer or whatever else. But it just wasn't part of the fabric. So it's interesting how it developed, I think.
Yeah, and while we're talking about awards, there could be a big award for Finn this evening because he hasn't said absolutely yet. So I'm looking for the opportunity to keep him honest in that sort of way. If you look up the Charles Brownlow or Chaz Brownlow, you'll find pictures of him in Wikipedia. If you want to judge anybody by anything, it's the mustache that he's got under that nose of his. That is like a privet hedge. Yeah. There's no getting through that.
It's obviously the photos we've got are black and white, but I just hope it's red. Like, I just hope he's just got this big red, like, rhododendron kind of mustache. Yeah. And it is, you've got to look it up, guys. Like, it's a fantastic mustache.
It looks as if he has no upper lip.
No.
That it grows from his teeth outwards.
Yeah. He's a good looking man.
We'll post
Charlie.
One on Facebook.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. So the history of the award is an interesting one. We mentioned at the beginning of our episode that the 1924 was when it was kicked off, won by a guy called Edward Carji Greaves. So for the period of time from 24 through to 1930, it was one vote per game. The best on ground obviously got that one vote. Hence the such small numbers, you know, four being the least, and that ranged from seven or six through to about nine during that period of time. And in 1931, when Haydn Bunton wins first of his three, it switches to three votes delivered by the one umpire. And eventually when they move to two, it becomes shared. There is a period of 2 years, 1976 and 1977, I think, where both umpires vote, hence huge numbers for Graham Teasdale and Graham Moss, who polled 48 and 59 votes.
Yep.
And generally, the winner has polled about 20 votes to win across a period of time, which is why Dustin Martin's wonderful victory the other night is a record breaker, 11 best on ground.
Mm.
He's broken all those records and 36, which is, you know, double what Wanganeen won within 1993.
The award, I think we should note, is that most people think it's best and fairest.
Yeah.
Well, they say it's the best and fairest. But the award specific criteria is fairest and best, very specifically. And this is probably reflects an emphasis on sportsmanship or that gentlemanly play, which you just talked about, Miller, and that fair play before actual ability, and which may also explain the decision to have the votes cast by the umpires rather than, you know, watching the game again, which would you obviously focus on ability and stats and all these types of things. One year in 1940 where we had a countback system, which we talked about from 1924-1930, where it would be the player that had the least amount of games would win if there were a tie.
Yeah.
But then in 31 to all the way up to 1980, it was the person with the most three vote games.
Most best on ground.
Yep. And then if that was even, most two vote games.
Yep.
However, even with these considerations, in 1940, the countback failed to separate Des Fothergill and Herbert Matthews, who tied for the medal in 1940. So the league decided to keep the original medal and award a replica for the two winners. So up until 1980, there was no winner for 1940 because you couldn't have a player, you couldn't have two players having the medal.
I've got a couple of interesting useless facts around this. Most games without a Brownlow vote. Tom Lonergan, 191 games, no Brownlow vote.
Wow.
Yeah, which
that's
is
a great start. I love that.
Hayden Bunton polled at least one vote in every game, on average, at least one vote in every game that he played. I think I love this man. He won three Brownlows, but also won three Sandover medals, which is the waffle version of the Brownlow, and played during a war period as well. So he effectively had 3 or 4 years of his footballing life cut off, and he still manages to win six league best and fairest. That's amazing. And apparently all-round nice guy, you know, never involved in rough play. You can see him. He's got one of those bronze statues outside the MCG where he looks like he's gliding with the ball under his arm.
Yep.
He also plays around the same time as one of your favourites, Finn. Dick Reynolds does the same thing.
Dick Reynolds, three Brownlows as well. And we should, talking about people that have won multiple awards, Hutchinson, the great Essendon player.
Bill
Hutchinson.
Yep.
He didn't have multiple awards until 1989.
Oh,
When the VFL decided to award retrospective medals to the 8 players who had tied in previous years.
Yeah, okay.
But lost on countback. So that meant Collier and Hopkins in 1930,
yep,
which we've just talked about. Folligoo and Matthews. Austin in 1949, Hutchinson in 52, Howe in 59, and Teasdale in 65 finally had their Brownlow medals.
And that Noel Teasdale is not to be confused with the brown velour suit wearing Graham Teasdale in 1977.
Beautiful suit.
It was the very first time and last time for that to happen at a Brownlow medal count. I didn't see any brown suits on Monday night.
No,
the Brownlow.
The men are certainly a bit more straight down the line with their attire, that's for sure. There's been some crackers over the years, though.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, the one that really jumped out, just to go off topic totally, is tartan waistcoat with the tartan bow tie that James Hurd on the year he wore. Like, what on earth is that?
Yeah.
Never seen anything like it. It totally jumped out at me on Monday. I just couldn't believe it. Yeah. But it does happen. It does happen, I guess.
Yeah, so the interesting thing about people winning numerous awards is this: a very similar thing happens in the 60s and 70s, or most of the 60s and 1971. Ian Stewart wins three. Bob Skilton, playing around the same time, he wins three as well. So it's amazing that the two winners, the four winners of three Brownlow medals each, two of them played at the same time. You know, that's incredibly interesting. And it leads us to consider exactly how voting systems can continue to change after the period of time, 1977. It goes to 1-3-2-1.
Yeah.
So the two umpires have to confer and agree on 3-2-1.
Yeah.
And the very interesting thing about our system now is that no one gets a look at them apart from those umpires then and there.
Yeah.
They write down the three names. It goes straight into an armoured car.
Yeah.
You know, like it's Jules on the Snatch movie or something.
Yeah. Channel 7 made a massive deal about this on Monday, I don't know if anyone saw, but the armoured car and the guys who were bringing it out, like close-ups of the car, like what's going, you know, what on earth is going on?
Yeah, that's right.
Like one guy just bring it up in a bag. Like, you don't need, like, anyway, yeah. They did a good job of increasing the tension in the room.
That's right. And I'm sure Chubb Security, whoever they were, made a pretty penny out of it.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a weird sort of thing because, you know, the umpires who vote on that game know the result of that game, but they're obliged never to talk about it for any reason. And the 9 games that elapse each weekend, there's no way that an umpire could know who is polling much better than anyone else apart from the games that they have officiated in. So It's all very private and secret. It is, it's such like something out of James Bond, really.
It's such a unique thing. It really is. I was, comparing with the Dali M medal, the NRL Rugby League medal. So they have sort of open voting until round 14, and then they shut it down. I didn't even know this until this week. So, but you know what the votes are to round 14. So I can say for the 2017 season, Cameron Smith at round 14 was 4 votes ahead, okay, of anyone else in the competition. And everyone knows this. And then they shut down the voting and go, oh, that's enough, we'll wait. Which I think is like a totally bizarre way of doing it.
Well, it's like open Mazaire until there's 4 hands and left go, no, and then no, you no. pick up your cards. Yeah, you can't see anymore.
So, yeah, there's some fascinating ways of doing it. But
is it true you've been doing some research around other MVP? Because I've been seeing weird things that on that screen over there.
Yeah, I did that again. I've got a few tabs open here from World Sport. That's becoming my role, I think. And that's fair enough as well, because
listeners I've spoken to are very impressed with the Slovenian Basketball League and their 13 clubs.
It's worth a read. It's an hour I won't get back. Anyway, so it was like looking at world... And this is where it was so fascinating to me about the fact that what the Brownlow has become, and we might talk about this in a second, about where it sort of maybe came from in South Australia, maybe at this point not getting enough credit from us. But if you look at World Sport and start looking at the way certain places do it, obviously MVP, which I suppose comes from the NBA, the American Basketball leagues, that's basically a panel of individuals who vote on that award. Okay, and they say like former players. These are the best. This is the best player for the year, and they actually do it 3 times during the year. But
it's more of an appointment than it is a sort of ongoing voting.
Yeah, scenario. That's right. Yeah. It's just like at this point, you are the most valuable player. Yes. But I guess it's really fascinating. For example, if you look at the English soccer system, they have got what they call the Players Association Award, which used to be the Football Association Award. But that's voted for by the players.
Yes.
And all the players pick their best, which also exists in the NFL, of course. But I really went out of my way to try and find another example of officials voting for the award. And I really was excited to go, oh, look, I've got the Georgian volleyball team who picked their team. But I can't find one. So if anyone out there can find one where the officials pick the award recipient for the year, we'd love to know about it, I guess, because I couldn't find one. But obviously, when you start getting into this stuff, you do start finding some really weird things.
What are you feeling?
So there's some phenomenal things that people get presented with. they don't get medals only. So golf's got some mental ones, like the guy who wins the Dubai Desert Classic each year gets like an orb and a massive dagger. That's what they give him, and that's a brilliant thing. Obviously trophies are insane. Like Stanley Cup and things like that, and the America's Cup, which is more impressive than the Stanley Cup. I think it's a huge thing, sailing cup, but. It's insane. Like NASCAR has got some of the best awards for people you've ever seen. Like NASCAR, one of them, they just give them a grandfather clock. Just to try, like, well done, you won NASCAR, which is, I think, fair to say, maybe a little bit, is Bogan the right term, NASCAR? Like, it's a little bit edgy at times, give him an ornate kind of grandfather clock for winning a couple of their races.
New South Wales, Queensland.
On the flip side, if you win the Italian Open Golf, you get like a massive wheel of cheese, which I think is really lovely. but my favourite by an absolute mile is the winner of the Illinois and Ohio State game and the best player in that game. So when Illinois play Ohio State in the American College Football League, the winner gets a giant wooden Galapagos turtle. and that's what they're given. Like, they get a giant wooden Galapagos turtle.
In the snap with 30 seconds to go, we want the bloody turtle. You've got to put it all on the line for the turtle now.
I really, really want the turtle. So... I was hoping to find some sort of nuggets of gold around how voting maybe occurs and how
MVPs are celebrated around the world, and there's a bit of that in there, but if I'm honest, like, I maybe got a little bit off topic, boys.
You may well
start
have,
looking
yeah.
at some of the most mental trophies I've ever seen in my life.
I always thought that the green jacket always seemed quite odd to me.
Yeah,
because of all the colours of jacket that I'm ever going to want to wear, green isn't one of them.
No.
And I thought, that's just... And they always present it in such a weird way, in a studio.
Yes.
With one guy and the other.
It's in the pavilion, I think. Like, in the pavilion. What am I talking about? In the clubhouse.
Yes.
Okay, where the former winner, so the winner from the previous year, presents the new winner with their green jacket.
But there's no cheering or anything that goes on. No, it's like just when one you guy. Hold up the Premiership Cup.
Yeah.
It's just one guy gives a jacket to another guy.
Yeah.
Says well done.
Yeah.
That's it. That after 72 nice. Holes, it's that's
very,
what you get.
It's very golf, isn't it?
It sure is.
I think going on that line of being kind of quirky is that if we bring it back to the Brownlow, Hawthorn has only ever had one actual winner in the traditional sense of coming out right first. And even that, so Shane Crawford in 1909.
Oh, yes.
He was one on his own. Even that was a little quirky, as in 1999, the medal took place in Sydney, the only year that that's ever occurred.
Oh, right.
And this is off the Hawthorn website. So Austin tied for the medal in 1949 that year, but lost on countback to South Melbourne's Ron Clegg with 23 votes. Dampier, Domenico and Platten both tied results. Again, going on the quirky theme, Dipper was the first ever Brownlow winner from Hawthorn at the time.
Yeah, wow.
And then finally, of course, we've got Sam Mitchell, who had a tie win.
Yeah.
In 2012,
yeah.
Due to Joe Watson being guilty of breaching WADA's anti-doping code, who was retrospectively ruled ineligible by the AFL Commission in November 2016. Yeah. So I thought that was a pretty interesting fact.
So while we're going for interesting facts, we're used to tuning into it on a Monday night, just after dinner, in the comfiness of our own lounge room. But from 1959 until 1970... you had to listen to it on the radio. A number of them used to put it on the radio and you used to listen to it. So 3UZ, 3AW and those sort of broadcasts used to put the vote count over. And then in 1970, the very first time it was televised, it was at Dulles Brooks Hall, which if you don't know where that is just across from the Fitzroy Gardens on Victoria Parade. Which is essentially where there's a hospital there and just near the Vic Brewery that we talked about the other day. This isn't to put down any of the other league's medals as being important, but this was always the Victorian Football League Brownlow and then taken on by the AFL. The McGarry, the Sandover, the Liston, the Lynch, Grogan, Phelan, Nichols medals are presented for their own respective leagues all around the country and are quite coveted.
I will stick up for the other states at this point, and I like the fact that the McGarry and Sandover predated the Brownlow medal as well, and South Australia, it looks like this has come from them. Like, it's been pinched by Victoria, and to be slightly controversial, because it's almost exactly the same in terms of the emphasis they put on fairest, as well as best player in the competition. Then it was adopted by WA with the Sandover medal in 1921. So the McGarry medal was 1897, which is 27 years before the Brownlow existed.
Yeah. And they were in sync with a few things, South Australia and WA, before the VFL, that no kicking in the ruck it ruled that they had running in their own state leagues that the Victorian Football League didn't have.
Yeah, so I suppose the idea of awarding the fairest and best player in the competition has probably come from Adelaide, I think.
Yeah, and it was an interesting thing. They talked for a little while about getting rid of it, that it would just be the votes that would get the job done, because, of course, now you can still vote for, as an umpire, still vote for a player who has been rubbed out. There was a little while where you couldn't, where if someone had been rubbed out as an umpire, you couldn't actually vote for him because that vote wouldn't count. Mm. The votes don't count now, but you are allowed to still award the best player on the ground, even if they've been suspended earlier in the year. But they were talking about getting rid of the fairest aspect of it, And I think Neil Roberts, a St Kilda Brownlow medalist, had said, well, if they get rid of that, I'll go down to the VFL and hand mine back. Because a number of these Brownlow medalists believe that that's one of the good things about it, that you can't just be a gun. You have to be a gun and play the game in a decent spirit. Not like Lee Matthews, if you're listening, thumping Neville Brunt.
Sure he is. I'm sure he is.
Bastard.
Oh, gee. A Geelong player's gone down behind the play.
So it's
Lee
Matthews.
Matthews goes
so
down.
Matthews in the centre.
A Geelong player went down. Matthews is down.
And there's many awards that exist that just have the best. So,
yes.
Miller, you just MVP, said it was the MVP of... You know, Australian rules, we have that.
Yeah.
Or the players.
Players most. Player, almost.
That's the best.
Yeah.
You know, we've got those awards already.
So other controversies around the Brownlow. When I was a child, it was always, oh, what will happen that time when the guy who's been rubbed out actually wins? Corey McKernan in 1996 had the same amount of votes as Hurd and Voss, but he'd been suspended for kneeing. It was a nothing much sort of suspension from memory, and a very sad day for Chris Grant when he polled more votes than Robert Harvey in 1997, and he was suspended for one match for striking. And then, look, really sadly from certainly Finn's point of view, is Joe Watson having his Brownlow medal, I don't know, rescinded, taken away, a word like that.
Which is tragic.
And even though Cotchin and Mitchell were retrospectively given those Brownlows, I don't know if that they'll ever be fair dinkum Brownlow medalists. So in my mind, anyway, they've got an asterisk next to
them. Yeah, look, it does come up, and it has been referred to by Channel 7 this week. Cotchin and, you know, the fact that you've got two Brownlow medalists going into a grand final. But for me, the biggest thing this week is whether or not Dusty's going to win the Norm Smith and do that for the first time. And that'll be the really exciting part about the weekend. Can he have both medals, which has never been done before?
And what an exciting time to be around Melbourne. I'd like to say thank you very much to Finn.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you to Ryan.
Thanks, guys.
And I'm happy for Dusty to get ahead of himself. But to the rest of you, don't get ahead of yourself and take it one game at a time.